Shrink Wrap Radio number 444, Dr. Maladoma Somme, an African shaman's wisdom for the West.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Maladoma Patrice Somme, who is a West African writer and shaman. He was born in Dano, Burkina Faso, into the Dagara tribe. For more information about Maladoma Somme, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Maladoma Somme, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much for having me on your wonderful program.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm pleased to have you on the show. I believe you used to live here in Sonoma County, where I'm located, and some of my friends worked with you. Perhaps you recall Larry Robinson and Francis Weller, both who've been prominent in the men's movement here. And I heard your name spoken often, but I'm sorry I never investigated further. Do you recognize those names?
I do recognize those names. They are a very close friend of mine. We have worked together in the late 90s and early 2000 quite extensively.
Yes, and Francis Weller in particular. By the way, I've interviewed both of them separately on this series as well. And Francis Weller was speaking a lot about grief, and somehow I have the impression that a lot of that was maybe due to your influence.
That's correct. It's wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah. So, and that was actually one of the very popular interviews. Somehow, that wisdom about grief that we all carry resonated with a lot of listeners, and a lot of people responded very positively to that.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful.
So you've come all the way from West Africa. What can you tell us about your origins in West Africa? I know it's a big story, but you can abbreviate it in whatever way you feel right.
I'll try to keep it as succinct and clear as possible. Of course, West Africa is a very large area to actually claim knowledge of. An area the size, 1.5 times the size of the U.S. So it's it's a big, large for someone to be a representative of. But the country I come from is called Burkina Faso, a former French colony that has the size of Colorado and about 16 million people. The Dagara people, I am part of, is not the largest tribal community. It only has about 1 million.
Uh-huh.
And they're located mostly in the southwest, southeast, of the country, right next to Ghana. And that's why I have relatives across the borderline, and this is partly because of history, you know. When Europe was dividing Africa, they didn't take into account the tribal territories.
Yes.
They just drew lines, and it turned out that some tribal community was split between nations, but some of them more than one.
That was already yeah, one form of violence that colonialism was doing in Africa.
Yeah, you know, one of the mildest, of course.
Yeah.
The borderline does not impress the tribal connection one bit. It's just that sometime crossing over to see a relative can be a small problem.
Yes.
But in the end, what is important is the recognition that the essential practices that define the tribal communities are kept steady, whether it is on one side of the border or the other. And this is what continues to serve as an ongoing link that basically ignores the political borders.
To preserve the cultural identity somehow.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And so this is where I come from, and this is the community whose practices I have become fully familiarized with. And I see, of course, a great deal of similarity between the spiritual beliefs, the community life, and all these different things that tribal community practices. I see a lot of similarity between that and other tribal community. You got to take notice that Burkina Faso, with its 16 million people, has 62 different tribal community.
Wow.
And that's not small. And
yeah.
It's just that when all is said and done, the language barriers are very, very minimum, because people do understand each other, beside the fact that they have their local language, but the linking language is, of course, the language of the colonizer, in this case, French.
Yes.
So, one way or another, it is utilized as the overarching communication tool to unite these various tribal communities. And
well,
so,
it turns out that your first name, Maladoma, has had some significance. And some significance for your life. So maybe you can share that with us and also talk a bit about your growing up there.
That's right. Of course, my name, Maladoma, which means the one who makes friends with a stranger, of course, has meant quite a lot of turmoil for me. I didn't know that making friends with a stranger was going to mean the kind of life itinerary that I've had to travel. The thing is that I started my early life, of course, within a typical family, complete with grandparents and parents. And it so happened that, you know, my grandfather was the healer, the shaman, in modern terminology.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to learn quite a bit from him. I got to learn quite a bit from being in family. And it was very early on in my life that I got taken away to the Catholic boarding school nearby for a few years, in the course of which, of course, I found myself, you know, having to confront a worldview that was quite radically different from the one that I grew up familiar with.
Yeah, and this is something that has happened elsewhere as a result of colonialism, and I'm thinking of in Australia, where Aboriginal population was forced to kind of lose their language, go to white schools, and so on. And even in this country, what happened with the Native Americans and, you know, other parts of the world. And then it seems like there's that Joni Mitchell song. I don't know if you know it. You don't know what you've lost till it's gone.
And that's right.
So now there's kind of this dawning awareness of, oh, these people have some wisdom that we need to know about.
That's right. All of a sudden, we discover that they have something.
Yes.
It is true. It is true. My case is not a unique one by any length of the perception. It's just that for me, for my healing, for my transformation, I felt the urge to really be personal about it by sharing it, talking about it, writing about it, and in so doing, I found myself in a state of transformation. Because, of course, any time when you separate from the culture of your origin, what happens is that the merger with the new culture always result in some inner trauma of one type or another, the result of which in the end creates what might call a person from two worlds.
Yes.
Whose identity is constantly questionable. And the longing for the original purity cannot stop, but at the same time, you realize, as has been observed by some of the elders in my village, that there is certain fundamental condition that is staying in the way of the embrace of the kind of originality that those who haven't had this experience are enjoying. Namely, for instance, something common here such as literacy, the capacity to read and write that most people take for granted, can be seen by indigenous people as an obstacle to originality. And of course, I've had over the years a great chance to think about all of these. There is such a thing as literacy when it comes to the capacity to learn and acquire the depth of the wisdom of one's people. And this comes with a certain kind of literacy that is not to be defined in the standard way as we define literacy here as a capacity to read and write.
Yes.
My culture know how to read and write, but not in the Roman way, not in any of the way that is public here, is common knowledge here. When I used to see my grandfather scribble something on the ground as if he's marking certain kind of geometric territories and use that as a frame of reference to read certain detail. I mean, it was I should consider that one form of literacy. At any rate, about that in terms of identity.
Yeah. Now, in terms of identity, and you describe yourself as a man of two worlds, clearly there are challenges associated with that and pains associated with that and also benefits. So maybe you can – what are the challenges and pains I think you've alluded to a little bit, and what are the benefits of having been in two worlds?
I prefer to start with the benefit. Okay. Having gone through the pain and spoken about the pain over and over again to the point where I've had the impression that I've only conveyed way too much of this aspect without the blessing part.
Okay.
As they say, you know, it's a general belief that the blessing must be looked at from deep inside the wound.
Okay.
So the wound of modernity is what has transformed and translated into a blessing for me. And the blessing for me at this juncture is to see that being a man of two cultures, I'm able to see what each culture needs from the other. What is essential that the one can offer to the other in the interests of a global village or a better communication or something of that nature?
Yes.
It seems like as the world goes and changes constantly, what happened is that in the end, we need more and more of more people who live in two worlds in order to serve as a linking point for cultures to come together, to share universal view, drawing from the wisdoms of their ancestors, and things like that. Uh-huh. And this is what, for me, make me look at myself as a blessed person who has gone through the kind of initiation necessary to acquire this posture that is helping the cultures of two worlds come together in a handshake that is life-giving.
You know, I'm really interested in this sort of move from the negative side of your story to the positive side of your story. And I identify with it in a way because my own growing up was a bit in two worlds, and my story was very precious to me, and I kind of held it very close, and I felt like it made me really special. But as I've gotten older, I kind of got tired of my story and sort of outgrew it, you know. And,
welcome to my world.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. You grow tired of it.
Yeah,
this is simply because, you know, this is not like a label that you have to use as a way of defining yourself. You got to be able to move on,
yes,
to move out and on forward to something that is continually exciting. New,
yeah.
You know, the new frontier idea works in this context.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see. So you were, in a way, you were kind of ripped away from the tribal village of your youth, and kind of forced to go to French schools, punished for speaking your language, forced to speak French, and so on. And then at a certain point, I think when you were in your late teens, you returned to your village and you were put through a very powerful initiation ceremony.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about that process?
Yeah, I used the term earlier on, but the initiation itself must be looked at from the perspective of this kind of radical transformative process that allows for a better understanding of the, call it the sanctity of the human being and the journey the human being is blessed with.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't even have the proper term, but the issue is that initiation, as I experienced it, that took 6 weeks in the jungle to happen, supervised by a circle of elders, was pretty much a series of, call them ritual experiences, ritual involvement, that had the benefit of broadening the horizon of perception, sharpening the vision, and cooking the body, the mind, and the spirit in such a way that in the end, there was like a lifting up of the self from one state of consciousness to another.
Mm-hmm. I love that image of the cooking.
That's right. And it did feel like a cooking.
Yeah.
Because in it was mostly the hardship that defined initiation. At least for me, that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
Tremendous, tremendous stretch of the physical body to the point where comfort is moved out completely. And the sheer discomfort of the whole experience was like the contributor to this rise to a broader consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for me, this was the turning point, because on the one hand, it showed that having survived such a radical experience, I now had something to hang on to that defined my belonging to the community that I had separated from earlier on.
Yes.
The second thing is that it actually prove not to be in contradiction with the knowledge acquired at the Jesuit school, the Catholic school. In fact, it was something that helped me make the differentiation between streams of consciousness in that are indigenous and streams of consciousness that are so-called modern.
Uh-huh.
This parallel really contributed to the fashioning the sense of being in two worlds.
Yeah, yeah. And we should let listeners know that, I mean, a little bit about your educational journey, which has spanned three continents and, you know, has got something to do with the literacy with which you converse right now in Western terms.
Absolutely.
But also the other kind of literacy that you were talking about in terms of indigenous culture. So just give us a quick outline of your three-continent education.
Well, I studied first, in my country at the university until I completed a master's degree in modern language, in linguistics, and in literature. And then I moved on to France at the Sorbonne, where I obtained a PhD in political science. Then I moved on to this side of the shore in the United States, namely at Brandeis University, where I did a PhD in English and American literature. Why? Partly because a lot of the culture of modern society are best seen in its literature.
Yes.
That represent the stories from the storyteller of the culture, like there are storytellers in Daguerre culture. It helped to understand the world view of the culture that you're in. And so literature was a pretty good choice for me to better understand the culture that I was living in and was going to be working in.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant idea. I know when I was in college, I immersed myself in fiction. Not for courses that I was taking, but I felt like it was important at some level. I couldn't articulate why it seemed to me to be so important to be reading all this fiction, but I think you've just articulated it quite well.
Oh, thank you. It is useful in this context because over the years, in the past 20 years since I started going to Burkina Faso with some Westerner, it has helped me to see how a bunch of people that I take there who are only versed in the culture of their origin relate to another culture when they enter it. You can see how much struggle they are under trying to understand the culture they've entered into from the perspective of the one that just left.
Yeah.
The one that shaped them. It could be either very funny or very painful to watch.
Yeah. So, so what happens ultimately? I don't know how long these visitors get to stay, but do you see any sorts of changes as a result of that?
Well, the changes are changes that are consistent with their capacity to be flexible, to go with the flow,
yeah,
and to at least give the benefit of the doubt to anything that really challenges their imagination or even their originality. And so, therefore, I have seen from very good changes to very bad reaction, mm-hmm, almost like someone who is fully allergic
yeah,
to someone who cannot have enough of it. Yeah.
Right. Right. I can imagine both extremes.
Now, yeah, the spectrum is very large.
Yeah, I don't know if this is still the case, but in your book that I read, you said that you needed to go back to your tribe on an annual basis to go through a cleansing ceremony. And so I got the sense that in some way you found that the Western culture was toxic for you. Has that changed, or is that still the case?
That has not changed. That has not changed. One consistent thing that I've noticed in the past 25 years has been that when I'm engaged in Western culture for an extended period of time, I begin to feel the weakening of my batteries. Mm-hmm. My perspective become dim, and my longing very high. Yes. Longing to go back in order to immerse myself again. It is as if my soul needs a cultural bath.
Yeah.
Some kind of thorough bath that will allow me to re-enter this culture from, feeling up to beat, up to par with what I'm supposed to do.
Yes.
And so I've had to maintain that partly because it's part of my survival.
Yes,
and
I
also because
that.
I need this kind of coming and going in order to maintain even the whole idea that I'm a man of two worlds.
Mm-hmm. Now, to some degree, or maybe not to some degree, but very explicitly, the elders of your culture kind of sent you to the West on a journey to carry a message.
Well, of course, you got to understand this, the whole concept that Dagua people seem to believe strongly in, that a person comes into this world sent by the ancestors to fulfill a task. And that for that reason, that person is given enough tools that the person needs to expect to use on an ongoing basis if he or she wants to fulfill that task. This is why it is embedded in the name that is attributed to the person, partly because it is a tribal belief that the name you carry is also an encapsulation of the gift that you came into this world with. And so therefore, the more you hear that name, the more it is a reminder of what you are bringing with you into this world. There's something quite interesting about that. It is interesting because in the end, a person's name is most likely the one sound or the one word they're going to hear more often than anything else.
Huh.
And so to think of it as a constant reminder of what you are here for is almost really like an affirmation, a confirmation of the fact that your presence in this world is not a random thing.
Yes.
And that you are an envoy. In other words, that you are important. That's why you got a name.
I like that.
So, of course, that's why I've ended up emphasizing more on the name Maladoma than the Christian name that was given to me, which is Patrice. Simply because, of course, the specifics of the work that I'm doing demand that I hear that name being called more often than Patrice.
Yes. Now, I'm wondering, something that just popped into my mind is to wonder about any interactions that you might have had during your years here with African Americans who have really been ripped away from that culture, and what's your experience been?
Well, my experience really has been something similar to what I was saying earlier about the need to find the blessing deep inside the wound. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've discovered, sad to say, was that the blessing is yet to be found in the wound. Mm-hmm. And the realization that, of course, African American are African in origin and have been here against their will, have been brought here against their will, and subsequently losing their culture, losing touch with their culture and their ancestor, simply has a deep effect on this whole idea of gift and purpose, of the beauty that defines identity and affirms the whole idea of gifts. I think that this is a part that I've always been emphasizing with my brothers and sisters of African descent, knowing that it is also my responsibility to bring them up to date about the importance of reconnecting with the culture of their ancestors, partly because their being here is not really any different from my being here. And, of course, the wound is so overwhelming that it takes a lot more intense and radical ritual healing in order to begin this so-called janitorial work upon their psyche, their soul, to get to that shining piece that I refer to as the gift.
This reminds me of one of my other guests, an African American man who has gone back into his community to work with young people, and they employ storytelling and drumming, and he's able to connect with disenfranchised youth by drawing on those sorts of practices, kind of archetypal practices.
Yeah, that's very important because, indeed, this is one of the few cases that reminds me that, here are people who have indeed made the breakthrough and recognizing that the journey forward involves a journey back,
So, there's been a lot of interest in shamanism in certain quarters of the West, but mostly it's been about shamanic traditions from other parts of the world other than Africa,
South America, you're right. And so on. You're right about that, simply because there hasn't been too many voices out of Africa as loud as can be to actually bring into the public the wisdom of Africa in a way that is... to use some of the word that come from my fellow African American, that is digestible, understandable, that can be broken down into pieces. Mm-hmm. And this is why these teaching that I've been doing have been having a lot of response from people, positive response, simply because, as I say, it's accessible. Opaque or deeply hidden nature of African wisdom makes it that much inaccessible to any person who wants to get it, call it logically, as well as grow from it, as if it is a body of practices that are life-sustaining and confirming of one's identity and so on and so forth.
So do those rituals and practices then need to be transformed or changed in some way to make them fit into, you know, this very different environment here?
I believe the requirement is more about the need for more people who feel themselves as people from two worlds, living in two worlds, who understand the depth of these ritual in a way that they can therefore bring to the other shore in a transformative, explanatory, structural way for people to understand and to digest.
Yeah, yeah, and there are a number of such people around. I'm aware
of that. That's right. Absolutely.
And you've written that there is an indigenous person within each of us, and I believe that's true. Although bringing it out may be challenging.
I mean, that's a big challenge, indeed. Yeah. And eventually, it would take people who are, let's call them shepherds of the human consciousness, capable of awakening that indigenous self, who then can begin to reflect on all these ritual practices from a perspective that leads to greater understanding. And that is the difficult part. I have to call it challenging, because you know, the fast pace of modernity comes with very little time to devote into introspection, meditation, and reflection of the type that can eventually shed some light into these rather esoteric ritual practices.
Yes. So what do you feel that your own African shamanic tradition has to offer Westerners, especially considering our historical and cultural roots are so different?
Well, in fact, it is. It has this power of confirming or restoring the human quest for authenticity, the human quest for a larger than life experience. To put it more simply, it really has had the effect of bringing to light a lot of things that many people have been feeling, experiencing, without a frame of reference that is earthly, that is something that is like an echo from the past, making them realize all of a sudden that, oh, all these things they've been feeling deep inside, that's more like their indigenous self partaking in their consciousness to show them directions that are pertinent, that they should be following, or they're following. And now they hear that a tribal community from out of nowhere is actually confirming the thing they've been feeling all along. And so all of a sudden they have a context. They have a place to situate all these things that they've been holding on to themselves, because they were afraid of that people may think, if they talk about it, people may think that they're losing their mind or something.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking a little bit about the psychedelic revolution of the 60s and sort of people who have that sort of hunger that you're talking about. And I think they were reaching for a technology to induce a dramatic altered state, return maybe to a more original sense of the world, or to shatter the categories. And I don't know if substances play a role in your culture, but it seems to me that maybe the rituals that you talk about can have a similar effect.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Unfortunately, of course, Dagara people don't use very, very much substance. But I've come to understand it as meaning that, you know, when a culture has a grasp of the cosmology and the connectivity that they need to sustain themselves, maybe they become disinterested in using boosters or whatever that is, the culture that needs to transcend the opacity of the movement, to break into the other dimension that they long for, are the one that can't help but use whatever nature can offer them to get there.
Oh, I love your passion.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about the Dagara metaphysics, if you will, about the sense of what is real, because it's as you've described it, is very different in some ways. Where do they believe we came from, and where do they see us going, if you will?
Well, first of all, the thing about it is that Dagara's sense of reality is not limited to the five sensical reality that is so common elsewhere. The point for them is that we come from a realm. The Dagara people refer to as a realm of the ancestors. We were there before we came here. Mm-hmm. The coming here didn't follow a sequential linear pathway, but nonetheless, it is part of of the reality involved in what you may call a subspace journey from one dimension to another. Assuming that where we are, the reality that we're in right now, are the reality of a specific dimension. So coming from the ancestors, as an individual who has obtained the permission to participate in the construction of this reality, in other words, I'm trying to suggest that Dagara people believe that this world is a place of in construction. We have to build and participate in the beauty of this planet. And so that's why it is so exciting for entities that are in the realm of the ancestors to want to be here, because this is where the action is. There's a lot to do.
Yeah, there is a lot to do here.
And so we gather all kind of tools and materials because we know that these tools are going to be useful. Mm-hmm. It's just that when we come here, we arrive, the arrival is so rough that a lot of that get lost in translation.
Mm-hmm.
And we start wondering whether we made a mistake or not, because everything looks like a bit foggy. We feel something inside, but we don't have a mirror outside in order to confirm. Therefore, we go on a quest, a search for something that is larger than life, a search for something that transcends the five senses that we use to relate to what we have ended up labeling reality. In the end, some of us make certain kind of breakthrough that they want to pass on to the other who are also on the quest. Not everybody's journeying at the same speed, mm-hmm. on the same road. And therefore, it is this contribution that demands a sense of community in order that the sum total of the gift, known and unknown, can help foster a new vision, a grander vision, a sense of greater presence in this dimension.
Okay. So then what's your view of death then in that context?
Well, you would never really die. It's a journey back to where we started.
Okay.
In other words, our gift is such that it only requires a certain number of years to deliver them. And when we're done delivering them, then we don't need to be here anymore. We return to our place of origin. Unfortunately, there are a lot of us who apparently got so lost that sometimes they have to be recalled prematurely simply because, it's like, this is hopeless. Let's reset the button, come back, and reload so that you can return and in the hope of doing better. So that's why the whole perception of reality is almost like this kind of commuting thing. We commute from one place to another. It's just that the journey from home, which is the ancestor, to here, which is the working place. When we arrive at the working place, we need to sit in the office for about 70, 60 years, 80 years, sometimes 100 years before we go back home.
So what's your understanding of the nature of evil? Where does that fit into the picture?
Well, evil is a mirror of the soul, or should I call it the consciousness, that has a lot of evolving to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows also the kind of job yet to be done. In other words, the reason why we come here is directly connected with why we witness what we call evil. Evil is a definition of how much more we human who have arrived here still need to do in order to complete the beautification of this planet.
So in a way,
it means we still have a lot to do.
Yeah, we keep coming back to that. What about men and women's relations? Do you have a perspective on that in terms of the special gifts or responsibilities?
That's true. The perception must be seen within the context of the function of the feminine versus the masculine. This is one level. Feminine and masculine have very little to do with gender. In other words, in Dagra culture, we have those we call the male mother. And the female fathers, which means that in fact, feminine is essentially assigned the task of the, call it the concoction of life, the furthering of life, the bringing of the nurturing, the comforting, the sheltering of life in general. In fact, feminine is essentially earth-like. The earth is the mirror of the feminine. That's why the earth is unconditionally loving, giving endlessly. And as such, the feminine and the mother, they go together in such a way that in the larger picture, the sustenance, the maintenance, and the support of life become its main goal. Whereas the masculine is the protective, the kind of special agent, call it secret service, the one that is meant to provide the structure, the context, the kind of delineation of the space of safety for life to blossom and to provide and connect with other lives. So masculine is essentially service. Service to the wellness of all. And this is why when these two entities are not cooperating, there is a tremendous imbalance that translates into quite a bit of stress violence, deception, conspiration, or whatever they want to call that.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Conspiracy.
Oh, that's right. Oh, conspiracy. See, I'm thinking French while talking English. and all of these things that go on, more about a reminder that, in fact, there is an imbalance that demands that everybody's mind be oriented in that direction as opposed to pointing fingers.
Yeah. Now, you also talk about the relationship between the young and the old, and I ask that as a grandfather.
Yes, absolutely. And that was, I talk about it simply because of my experience of it. Was the most beautiful thing that I was blessed with as I entered this life. The culture I come from sees grandparents as a sibling of grandchildren. Mm-hmm. As if your grandchild is of the same age as you.
I can feel myself approaching that age.
Partly because, you know, the grandchild just arrived from the very world that you're coming dangerously close to getting into. And therefore, naturally, you guys have something in common. Yeah. You got to exchange notes. You know, the grandparents have something to say to the grandchildren about this world that they have been in for quite some time. And the grandchildren, fresh from the world that the others are going to, have some stories to tell too.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
And so as a result, you know, they kind of, they kind of hang out together for this very good reason. As long as they are well together, something become quite beneficial to the community at large.
Yeah.
And this is part of the reason why it is in the presence of grandchildren that grandparents can better understand the sanctity of legacy.
Mm.
They can pass on something.
Yeah.
Give the baton of continuity to the new arrival and proudly move on to the other world.
Yeah, yeah. Now, a lot of my interest as a psychologist has been in dreams. How does your culture look at the meaning of dreams?
In fact, we don't call them dreams. We call experience in the course of one's sleep. It's what you see when your consciousness is no longer distracted by the many kind of distraction in the time of your wakefulness.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a different kind of consciousness. And so this is where all kind of subtle information are provided. A lot of them are symbolic. A lot of them are just more like the compact discourse provided for the sole purpose of your deciphering capabilities. And this is why when in the village, a parent has a pertinent dream like that. The next day, they have to go in consultation in order to seek the help of someone else to better understand what that message is, which means that dreams are essentially messages delivered into us by the other world's post office for us to read carefully and get the message, for God's sake.
Yeah, good. Now there is this sense of magic in the tribal world that you grew up in, and for the sake of being open and honest with you, I have to tell you, I really struggle, as much as I resonate to everything that you're saying here, mm-hmm. I really struggle with some of the stories of magical events, such as you're running into a little, what's the word in Ireland? A little person.
Oh, the leprechaun.
The leprechaun person. Or the firing.
The contumely.
Or the firing of the arrow through your grandfather's roof, and it travels so far and it kills a beast and it returns. That's my Western mind with all of its rigid categories.
Right. The Western mind is so stuck with a certain kind of paradigm that indeed things like this that were referred to as magical do not really have enough space to settle in. And yet we see a lot of that in Western media, in movies, you know, in what they call science fiction, where, you know, in that culture, they will say that your mind cannot capture a reality like this if it doesn't exist anywhere. Because the mind is designed to go hunting for that which exists, not that which doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know? And so, of course, the challenge that you feel is consistent with the success of your culture in conditioning you in such a way that you do have allegiance to what constitutes a graspable reality, something that you can insert into your life, and so on and so forth, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of interesting
and
some Westerners.
We need to kind of filter out.
Okay,
stuff, right, to hold on to our structure.
And it is, your filter need to be more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. Maybe you need to upgrade it to to give it to get the most expensive one, by the way, and it will at least afford you a larger field of apprehension of reality yet to enter the field of wisdom of this culture.
Okay.
And the more effort you make in that direction, because you're already somewhat on that way. You're not completely that rugged fundamentalist who only sees reality in certain ways and any other reality can't fit in. Otherwise, you and I won't be able to talk at all.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So the thing is that it is the recognition of the limitation of the tool of filtration that actually should be seen as a credit to your commitment to journey further and to explore new frontiers in the human consciousness.
And I'm going to hang on to that.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Now, what about healing? You know, you position yourself as a healer. What's your view of healing? And then I want to ask about your view of mental illness in that context.
Healer is not so much the kind of generic thing that consists in providing certain kind of herbs and concoction for somebody to take so that their metabolism can transform and be upgraded in such a way that they feel better. In fact, what is healing? At the core of healing is the rise of consciousness, because the real healer is us. It is the indigenous in us that has the capacity and the resilience necessary to make breakthrough every time we come face to face with an obstacle that the mind cannot figure out. You can't stand in the face of a wall thinking that it's a door, because it won't change into a door. But if you therefore expand your imagination, you may realize that this wall is a reminder that if you turn slightly left or slightly right, you may find a breakthrough there.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently, healing, the kind of healing that I'm more drawn to, is really the one that I see in a person whose indigenous self has grown a few more inches in size and making that person take responsibility for their own transformation and their own change, their own wellness, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like, in the end, it is not about a categories of healers and a categories of beneficiary of such healing. It's more like we are all in this world as healers. It's just a matter of where we are in our consciousness and how willing to put up with the, to put up the right kind of fight we are.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. There's a psychologist colleague who has who talks about attitudinal healing, and he's created a network of people involved in attitudinal healing.
Oh.
And that's a. That's a nice way of positioning it, I think, of saying something similar to what you're saying.
Well, yeah, because what he's doing is actually begin with the strong belief and acknowledgement that each human has somewhere in themselves a healing power. And that if they keep excavating themselves, the wall of their psyche, they will pull that out eventually, and it's going to help them much better than a third party in whose office they can go to and sit there hoping to buy something that is going to change their lives once and for all. You know.
Yeah. So what's your view of mental illness?
You know, mental illness is the last opportunity of modernity. It is, you know, from the perspective of my culture, it is the initial rise of the shamanic person that is being labeled clinically.
Mm.
In my village, every person that ever became a powerful healer start mentally ill. Schizophrenic, you might call it.
Huh.
Psychotic, you should add, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And whenever somebody, a young person, an old person, start going that way, those who know are happy. You can see the glow in their faces because they know a new healer is coming to the world, is being born.
Yeah.
And if, to the point where here in the modern world, if this idea applies, what happened is that all these people who are clinically labeled in this fashion, what would have happened if they were approached from a slightly different perspective, acknowledging that their psychotic breakdown, their schizophrenia, are a sign that a door to the other world is open to them for the sole purpose of making them instrumental to the wellness of the community they're in.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a very different experience, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. That's at least my belief. It will make a big difference, indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, on your website, I see that you offer one-to-one divinations. Is this a kind of fortune telling or what?
Oh, hell no. actually, what I call divination is not unlike what we talked about earlier. It's more like this kind of counseling indigenous style in with the hope that a person gets a better understanding of the circumstances they're in that make them want to come and sit with me, but more importantly, in pinpointing their medicine and what they need to try out, what they need to do in order to check out the true powers that they carry inside, how to make a breakthrough by doing this and this and that, this ritual, that ritual, this offering, that offering. And more often than not, this is what happened to them. The breakthrough happened.
Uh-huh.
Wow. Well, I can tell, because then the one person referred two or three others because they're friends. They expect them to come. And this is what it's been.
You're very much in demand. And so something, mm-hmm. you know, what you're putting out there is definitely, people are responding to it. And so that
it is.
That gives us a good opportunity here to mention that starting on March 5th, you're going to be offering a 4-week video webinar through the Jung platform. And I've got kind of a relationship with Machiel and the Jung platform where of mutual support. So that's why I'm mentioning it here. What are you going to be covering in that series?
In fact, it's going to be a basic course in which my whole interest is to fill people in on the basic cosmological tenet of the culture that I come from, to give them a rather rounded up idea and picture inside of which they can then begin to reflect on their own medicine and the cosmology that serve like an umbrella under which they operate, and basically share the spiritual tradition of my people with everyone that may have some interest in it.
What benefit do you think people who participate may derive?
Well, the benefit is huge. First of all, it helps contextualize life in a way that is not just pure philosophy, but more earthbound, more nature-oriented, giving them a context to see how important they are in the grand scheme of things, as opposed to whatever or however they might be feeling about it right now. In the end, it really gives people a different perspective on the realities that they're familiar with. Or maybe it adds another dimension to what they already know. Therefore, providing them with a strong support, the kind that really tell those people who are maybe doubting that in fact they have no reason to doubt.
Yes.
The people who needed actually extra tool because they're interested in helping other people but don't know how to go about it.
Uh-huh.
To at least get one or two more tools to do their work better and more comfortably.
Yeah. Well, you know, as we wind down here, I wonder if there's anything you'd like to say by way of summary.
In fact, the one and only thing that I'm thinking about is what something's not too different from something I said earlier on, the fact that in this day and age, with the increasing propaganda of globalization, we are better off if we begin to think in terms of the global nature of spirit, the global nature of human culture and human wisdom, our deep connection with this earth, that this earth is therefore the best home that we're ever built for us.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can begin thinking that way, the one thing we will know is that we're all given one thing, very deep and very important. It is love and the capacity to share it.
Well, that's a great place for us to wrap it up. And I have to say it's been delightful speaking with you.
Made it so. Thank you for being so so open to these ideas and for stirring them out of me so vehemently.
Oh, good. Yeah. You reminded me of Dr. Martin Luther King. You got that same gift of you're a preacher man.
Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Maladorna Somme, thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap
Radio. Thank you for having me in this program.
Well, as you heard me say, Dr. Maladorna Somme is definitely a preacher man, and I mean that in a good way. I found speaking with him inspiring and energizing. I truly believe I understand his message, and it resonates with me for the most part. But I did feel obligated to share with him my own skepticism, or quotes, hardening of the categories, in terms of not quite being able to accept a literal version of some of the magical experiences he reports in his book of water and spirit. It was important to me to let him know that in the interview itself, because I knew I'd want to say something about my skepticism here, and I've learned that I shouldn't say anything in my post-interview commentary that I'm not willing to say directly. He took it in great spirit, I must say. And speaking of magic, how magical is it that this man who grew up in a tribal African village, and I who grew up in Los Angeles, and we've never met one another in person, and we are somehow able to come together magically using technical tools that neither of us built in a virtual space with a virtual audience of you out there that we can neither see nor hear and have such a meeting of minds and hearts. That's pretty magical when you come to think about it, and it would have been considered quite unbelievable until relatively recently. This would be an excellent book for you to own or to give as a gift. Remember, you can use the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar to order Of Water and the Spirit, or one of his more recent books that you'll find listed there on Amazon.com.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is just to let you know that I really appreciate your show, Across the Ocean here in the Netherlands. I've expressed that by a small donation. With regard to the work you put into your shows, it's just a small amount, but it's another way to say I value what you do. I'll keep listening, with heart and mind.
With heart and mind. How perfect, given what I just said without even knowing I was going to be using this clip. Thank you so much, Joris, there in the Netherlands, and also to all you others who helped to financially support my efforts here. I couldn't keep doing it without you. I'm happy to announce that due to the generosity of listener Kai Heimpel, there is a new transcript on our site, and it's number 358, A Soul-Centered Approach to Creativity with Jonathan Katz, PhD. He's a Jungian analyst, by the way. So thanks so much for this contribution, Kai. As you heard us mention in the interview, my strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has a new course coming up that I think you'll be especially interested in because for the first time, our guest, West African spiritual teacher Maladoma Somme, will be offering a video webinar about his tribe's elements of their cosmology. And those are fire, water, earth, mineral, and nature. And I deliberately avoided going into any of that in our interview so that you could get it during this webinar series, because they are profound catalysts to reclaiming your own personal power. This discourse of each element will inspire you as a listener and provide a unique glimpse into the healing wisdom of indigenous Africa. The African wisdom tradition has deep insights for practical living in the Western world, as you heard in our interview. Now, the course consists of four video webinars along with audio recordings for you to keep. The cost is only $99, but then you can subtract 15% during checkout when you use the code Dr. Dave. That's DRDAVE. Not only do you get a discount, but because of our affiliate relationship, it will also result in a small donation to Shrink Wrap Radio. So it will be a win-win. And maybe even a win-win-win-win. Now, the first session is on March 5th. They've got time to do it if you're hearing this when this show comes out. For full schedule and details and sign up, go to the promos tab on our site and then to the partners on the pull-down menu there, or you can just go to www.jungplatform.com and look for the information there. And while we're on all things Maladoma, let me remind you that his book Of Water and Spirit, Ritual Magic and Initiation in the Life of an African Shaman is available on audible.com. And if you're not already a subscriber to audible.com, it can be yours for free to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription. It can be yours by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. Or you can get any one of their other 165,000 titles.
I've been doing some hard traveling, I thought you knowed. I've been doing some hard traveling way down the road. With a heavy heart and a worried mind, Shrink Wrap Radio's a real good find. I've been doing some hard traveling, Lord. Pity's been doing some good listening, I thought you knowed. Dark the day's been podcasting way down the road. With a big fat mic and a soothing voice, you know he's offered you a real good choice. He's been doing some podcasting, Lord. I've been doing some deep traveling, I thought you'd knowed. I've been doing some deep exploring way down the road. With a happy heart and a bright spirit, life's calling me, ain't gonna fear it. I've been doing some deep traveling, Lord. I've been doing some wide exploring, I thought you'd knowed. I've been doing some self-exploring way down the road. With Jung and Freud and soul and psyche, Dr. Days in my ear to guide. We've been doing some wide traveling, Lord.
Speaking of virtual collaborations, that was Dr. James Alexander and myself blending voices and energy through the magic of the cybersphere. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag, and we have just one, and it's from Victor, who writes, just listen to episode number 409, A Gestalt Therapist Reflects on Mindfulness with Declan Ahern, PhD. And Victor says, this Irish psychologist hits it right on the spot. How can you disassociate spirituality from therapy or MBSR, that is mindfulness-based stress reduction? He goes on to say, we need more people like this in our society. We are spiritual beings, and trying to dissociate one from the other is like trying to separate the hydrogen from the oxygen molecules in H2O and pretend we still have water. Okay, well, that's well said, Victor, and it fits very well with today's interview. And so I think I'll close with that one. And you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Maladoma Somme, for sharing his message of African shamanistic wisdom with us. My next interview will be with French Jungian analyst Imelda Gaudissart, and we'll be discussing her book, which has just recently been translated from French into English, and it's titled Love and Sacrifice, The Life of Emma Jung. And Emma Jung was, of course, the wife of Carl Gustav Jung, and much of her life has been shrouded in mystery. All will be revealed when you join us next time. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.